I gave this talk several years ago as just a little unannounced extra at one of the conferences, and we had about 30 people, and they were sitting like this close, and we've got about twice as many this year. If you saw it a few years ago, you don't need to stay and watch it again, all right? And I'm going to need some help. You know, for hand class, you need two hands on different people. And so I'll get one of these guys in the front here to help. And one of you guys going to volunteer? Especially somebody that went through the endowment, so it would be helpful. Yeah? Well, I need somebody that has done it. Okay, somebody, you know, just be ready here when the time comes. All right, first of all, a disclaimer. I'm not a Mason, never have been. My description of these Masonic rituals are based entirely on written materials available on the internet, primarily on William Morgan's 1827 book, Illustrations of Masonry, which describes the York Rite of Masonry. I did receive my endowment, however, in 1952, which was long before the 1990 changes. So I got the old version, but it's based, some of the, my comments will be based on texts of the earlier endowment that was in force up until the 1940s. Now, many writers who are familiar with both the Masonic rituals and the Mormon temple endowment have remarked on their similarities as well as on their differences, of course. Many early Mormons were also Masons and acknowledged these similarities, usually asserting that the endowment was a purer, uncorrupted form, restored to its original purity, sometimes referring to the endowment even as celestial masonry. In the early days of the American Republic, many prominent men in America were Masons, including many of the founding fathers. Masonry was generally viewed favorably then. However, just before William Morgan published his book in 1827, revealing the secret Masonic rituals, and Morgan was a Mason, Morgan disappeared. And the general opinion was that he had been murdered by the Masons for revealing their secrets, violating their oath of secrecy. Now, the entire nation became outraged, and the anti-Masonic feelings swept the country. There was even an anti-Masonic political party, a national political party, which was formed in New York in 1827, which is the home state of William Morgan and Joseph Smith. The anti-Masonic view, of course, is clearly reflected in the Book of Mormon, which appeared soon afterwards, condemning secret combinations that required secret oaths. The tide of opinion changed after a few years, however. You know how soon people forget. And by the early 1840s, Masonry in America again enjoyed respect. And one of the main buildings in Nauvoo, Illinois, was a Masonic Lodge Hall. And the Nauvoo Lodge was very active. As a matter of fact, the Masonic Temple was completed before the Mormons completed the temple. In the Masonic Lodge, the Mormons were a majority of its members, including Joseph Smith, who became a third-degree Mason in 1842. In the years since Joseph Smith became a Mason and then 2 months later introduced the endowment in its full form, both Masonry and the endowment have undergone considerable changes. Both have done away, for example, with the original penalties. There are many essential differences between the two, even from the beginning. Both Masons and Mormons taught that the rituals were connected with Solomon's temple. Historical research has shown, of course, that ritual masonry is only a few centuries old. Even the Masons acknowledge that now. But Mormons still insist that they originated with Adam in the Garden of Eden. However, when we look at the similarities between the masonry of the 1830s in America and the early Mormon endowment that Joseph Smith introduced in 1842, one cannot help but see the likenesses. And the question arises whether Joseph Smith simply plagiarized essential features of masonry to produce his own ritual. Now, many Mormons today and ex-Mormons, we're sort of generally familiar. Oh, yeah, it's kind of, there's masonry, there's similarities with masonry. But if you press them to name the specific things, they can maybe come up with the square and compass, but that's as far as it goes. So what I'm going to try to do today is show you some specifics of the similarities. Now, some of the similarities are rather superficial and less significant than, for example, both rituals take place in places called temples. They both require special clothing. They both involve oaths. The rituals consist of moral and historical instruction presented dramatically based in events on the life of an important individual with the endowment, that's Adam, and then Eve, of course. With the Masons, it's the Hiram Abiff, who was the master mason in the construction of Solomon's temple. Their rituals are not for the public, only for the initiated. They claim to present secret knowledge. They require oaths of secrecy. They give the initiate a new name. They involve several levels of advancement. Each step of the advancement has an associated hand grip, a sign, a name, and a penalty at each step. And the penalties indicate ways in which life can be taken. And they involve special symbols. Now, some of the similarities, however, are so striking that their relationship is unmistakable. So that's what I'm going to present to you today. They're in no particular order today because the order of presentation in both ceremonies differs slightly. For example, in Freemasonry from the 1820s, these will all be from the 1820s versions of Freemasonry, the candidate is taken to a preparation room where all his clothes are removed, except his shirt. He is given a pair of special underdrawers. In the Mormon endowment, the patron removes all clothing and goes to a booth where he is clothed in a white undergarment. In Masonry, the candidate is conducted to the door of the ceremonial room, where he is caused to give, or the person conducting him gives, three distinct knocks, which are answered by from within, by three knocks from within. The conductor gives one more, which is also answered with one from within. The door is then partly opened, and the junior deacon inside asks, "Who comes there? Who comes there? Who comes there?" Now, in the endowment, at a point in the endowment, the patron is led to the veil of the temple, where a worker gives three distinct taps with a mallet. And another worker asks from behind the veil, "What is wanted?" At that point, there is a point where the senior deacon presses the point of a mason's compass against the candidate's naked left breast. The symbol of the compass in the endowment is placed in the patron's garment over his naked left breast. The meaning of the compass in Masonry is to keep us in due bounds with all mankind. In the endowment, the meaning of the compass is said to be an underlining course, an undeviating course leading to eternal life, a constant reminder that the desires, appetites, and passions are to be kept within bounds the Lord has set, and that all truth may be circumscribed in one great whole. In masonry, the point of the mason's square is pressed firmly against the candidate's naked right breast. In the endowment, the garment has the symbol of the square over the naked right breast. The meaning of the square in masonry is to square our actions. In the endowment, the meaning of the square is exactness and honor in keeping the covenants entered into this day. At the time in masonry, the candidate is said, the person officiating says to the candidate, "I also present you with a new name," which is caution. In the endowment, when the patron is clothed in the garment, the officiator says, "With these garments I give you a new name, which is never to be divulged." And the name is a name from the Bible or the Book of Mormon. Then in masonry, the entered apprentice gets a grip. And this is the description of the grip, and we'll have it demonstrated here. The right hands are joined together as in shaking hands, and each sticks his thumbnail into the third joint or upper end of the forefinger. In the endowment, the first grip, the grip or first token of the Aaronic priesthood is almost identical. You put the joints of the thumbs, the joint of the thumb over the first knuckle.
So you see that difference.
In masonry, the entered apprentice entered apprentice is shown the dugard or sign, which is bringing the hands to the front, palms 1 inch apart, and the master then draws his hand, right hand across his throat, the hand open, the thumb next to the throat, and drops it down by his side. That's the official description. So he does this. That's in masonry. Now, the sign and penalty of the first token of the Aaronic priesthood is, the sign is raising the right arm to the square, palm forward, thumb extended, and the penalty is to place the thumb under the left ear, draw the thumb quickly across the throat, drop the hand to the side, done while reciting the penalty oath. The oath, in connection with the dugard of the entered apprentice, is, "I do hereby solemnly swear that I will never reveal what I am about to receive, binding myself under no less a penalty than to have my throat cut across and my tongue torn out by the roots." And in the Mormon endowment, probably none of you are old enough to have gone through this version, and which was... No, wait, you haven't heard the... This was the way it was until about the mid-late 1930s. So if you went through what you thought was a penalty, it was not the old one. Here's what the penalty was in the Mormon endowment ceremony. The penalty of the first token of the Aaronic priesthood. "We covenant and promise that we will not reveal any secrets of this, the first token of the Aaronic priesthood. Should we do so, we agree that our throats be cut from ear to ear and our tongues torn out by the roots." Now that was the Mormon endowment ceremony. You see how they toned... it's namby-pamby stuff. I just suffer my life to be taken, you know. How are they going to, you know, do it? Also, I don't know if you noticed that those of you who did go get the penalty version, the so-called penalty version before 1990, it was not really a penalty. The wording was, rather than reveal the first token of the soul, I would suffer my life to be taken, which was completely different, because until the mid-30s, you promised that this is what would allow to happen to you if you did it. The implication being that it would be God's enforcers would be punishing you, and it was a real penalty. But to say that, oh, I will never reveal it because I'd let people kill me before I would reveal it, that's not a penalty. That's just saying how firmly you are going to resist telling, okay? But they still called it a penalty. All right, let's go on. In holding the, we're back in masonry now, the entered apprentice. The master and the candidate hold each other by the grip, which we just saw, and the master says, "What is this?" And the apprentice answers, "A grip." "A grip of what?" "The grip of an entered apprentice mason." "Has it a name?" "It has." "Will you give it to me?" "I did not so receive it, neither can I so impart it." And there's a similar one with each step of the grip. In the Mormon endowment, Peter gives Adam the first token of the Aaronic priesthood. "What is that?" Adam says, "The first token of the Aaronic priesthood." Peter says, "Has it a name?" Adam says, "It has." "Will you give it to me?" "I cannot, for it is the new name." And there is a similar dialogue repeated at the veil in the endowment. The name of the grip in masonry is Boaz. In the Mormon endowment, the name of the grip is the patron's new name. In masonry, the entered apprentice is given an apron of white lambskin, which is said to be an emblem of innocence. In the Mormon endowment, the patron is given a green apron, which is said to cover your nakedness. The next step in masonry is the next degree is the fellow craft mason. The due guard of the fellow craft mason is given by raising the left arm until that part of it is so that the part is perfectly horizontal, and the arm is raised like this. The second token of the Aaronic priesthood in the endowment is given by raising the left arm to the square, palm forward, right thumb, right hand extended forward to the waist with hand in cupping shape. The penalty in masonry is given by drawing the second degree, the fellow craft mason degree. The penalty is given by drawing your right hand flat with the palm of it next to your breast, cross your breast from right to left, and dropping it down to the side. The penalty in the Mormon endowment for the second token of the Aaronic priesthood is placing the right hand across the chest with the thumb extended, then drawing it rapidly from right to the right and dropping it to the side. So practically identical. In masonry, the wording of the oath connected with the entered apprentice is, "Binding myself, I'm binding myself under no less penalty than to have my left breast torn open and my heart and vitals taken from thence and thrown over my left shoulder to become a prey to the wild beasts of the field and the vultures of the air." You think that's bad, huh? But in the Mormon endowment until the 1930s, this was the oath or the penalty. "Should we reveal the secrets of the second token of the Aaronic priesthood, we agree to have our breasts cut open and our hearts and vitals torn from our bodies and given to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." There were two grips associated in masonry with the fellow craft mason, the pass grip and the real grip. The pass grip was also called the token, and it's given by taking each other by the right hand as though to shake hands, and putting his thumb between the first and second fingers and pressing the thumb between the joints. The grip of the second token of the Aaronic priesthood is given by clasping the hand, pressing the thumb between the hollow between the first and second knuckles of the hand.
Can you see how different they are?
The real grip is in masonry. Is similar, except you crook your thumb so that you can stick the nail of his thumb into the joint. We don't need to demonstrate that. The name of the fellow craft pass grip is Shibboleth, and the name of the real grip is Yachin. In the endowment, the name of the second token of the Aaronic priesthood is the patron's own given first name. Now, come to the Master Mason in Masonry. The sign of the Master Mason is given by raising both hands and arms and elbows perpendicularly, one on either side of the head, the elbows forming a square. The words are accompanying this sign in case of distress are, O Lord my God, is there no help for the widow's son? And as the last words drop from the lips, you let your hands fall in that manner, best to indicate solemnity. That's the sign of the Master Mason. Now, the sign of the first token of the Melchizedek priesthood, before 1930, this was changed, by the way, before 1930, the sign is made by bringing both hands to the square, palms in front. Both hands to the square, palms in front. I'm sorry, but with palms to the front. After the 1930s, the first sign was extending the right hand, palm down, thumb extended left hand, and the left hand in cupping shape, like this. Okay? That's the first sign of the Melchizedek priesthood. And since there were only 3 degrees in masonry, but 4 steps in the endowment, I'll mention the second token of the Melchizedek priesthood. The sign of the second token of the Melchizedek priesthood was elevating both arms above the head to represent the crucifixion. And then the word pale is spoken, the arms drop to the square, hail, and then to the side, ale. That is, pay, lay, ale. Pay, lay, ale. And you did it 3 times. Since 1990s, the words were changed to, O God, hear the words of my mouth. By the way, the Masonic penalty, or the Masonic sign of distress, which was raising your arms and then lowering them slowly like this, or saying, O Lord my God, is there no help for the widow's son? The Mason was to give either one or the other whenever he was in distress. And it's believed that when Joseph Smith was at the Carthage jail, when he appeared at the window, He tried to give the Masonic sign of distress by saying, O Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? But they shot him after, O Lord, my God. So he was trying to use the Masonic sign of distress when he was killed. The dugard, or penalty, for the Master Mason is given by putting the right hand to the left side of the bowels, the hand with a thumb next to the belly, drawing it across the belly, let it fall. Okay. That's the dugard, or penalty, of the Master Mason. The penalty of the first token of the Melchizedek priesthood, the right thumb is placed over the left hip, drawn quickly across the belly, hands dropped to the side. The oath, the wording of the oath in the Masonic, for the Masonic Master Mason was, binding myself under no less penalty than to have my body severed in two in the midst and divided to the north and south, my bowels burnt to the ashes in the center, and the ashes scattered before the four winds of heaven. Until the 1930s, the wording of the penalty in the Mormon endowment of the first token of the Melchizedek priesthood. Should we reveal these secrets, we agree that our bodies should be cut asunder in the midst and all our bowels gush out. The passcript in masonry of the Mason, of the Master Mason, is given by pressing the thumb between the joints of the second and third fingers where they join the hand. Grip of the first token of the Melchizedek priesthood in the endowment is given by placing the thumb on the back of the hand, the tip of the forefinger in the center of the palm, representing the piercing of the hand by a nail. It's called the sign of the nail, one of the few mentions of Christ in the endowment. The name of the passcrip of the Master Mason is Tubal Cain. The name of the first token of the Melchizedek priesthood in the endowment is the Son, meaning the Son of God. Now, the Master's grip in masonry is given by taking hold of each other's right hand as though you were going to shake hands and sticking the nails of each of your fingers into the joint of the other's wrist where it unites with the hand. It's sometimes called the lion's paw. Now, the grip of the second token in the Melchizedek priesthood is given in the endowment by clasping the right hands, interlocking the little fingers, placing the tip of the forefinger upon the center of the wrist, and it's called a patriarchal grip or sure sign of the nail.
Can we take notes so I can get in the
slush again? Well, yeah, except you haven't got your new name. You know?
If you're not mine.
Right. In the Masonic ritual, the important part of the third degree... by the way, you notice that there's no penalty in the Mormon endowment for revealing the second sign of the Melchizedek priesthood. And it's explained that there is no penalty stated, but you're under the same degree of... obligations of secrecy in the endowment. Why isn't there a penalty for the second degree of the Melchizedek priesthood, second token of the Melchizedek priesthood? It's because there were only three penalties in masonry, and Joseph Smith couldn't think of a penalty for the fourth one. You know? At least that's my theory. Yeah, right. Okay, the candidate goes through the symbolic murder of Hiram Abiff in the Masonic ritual, and he is struck and killed, and falls back into the arms of four Masons who are holding him to just break his fall. We won't do that, you know. But then he is raised, and he is raised up out of the grave by the Master Mason on the 5 points of fellowship. The 5 points of fellowship are the inside of the right foot to the inside of the right foot, right knee to right knee, the breast to breast, left hand to back, mouth to ear. Okay? So we can demonstrate. And in this position, he received, and he is held by, and he takes the candidate's hand in the Master's grip. So, you want to demonstrate that? Okay. Now he's been lying on the floor, and he's been raised up on the 5 points of fellowship. Inside of right foot to right foot, right knee to right knee. Breast to breast, hand to mouth, hand to back, mouth to ear. All right?
That's the 5 points of fellowship of the master degree in Mason.
Now, in that position, he receives the secret word of the master Mason whispered into his ear while in the 5 points of fellowship. Now, until 1990, the patron in the Mormon endowment converses with God through the veil on the 5 points of fellowship. Inside of right foot, right knee to right knee, breast to breast, left hand to back, mouth to ear, and in this position he receives the secret name of the second token of the Melchizedek priesthood while hands are clasped in the patriarchal grip.
I have to imagine that in the endowment, which is quite different, the veil of the temple is here. So through the curtain, this guy is representing God. He's reached through the veil, and we take his hands in the patriarchal grip. And in this position, through the veil, he gives me the name. He's asked me, what is that? And I answer, the second word, first sign of the patriarchal grip, the first sign of the name. And God says, hath it a name? It has. Will you give it to me? I cannot, for I have not yet received it. For this purpose I have come to converse with the Lord through the veil. You shall receive it upon the 5 points of fellowship through the veil. And then God gives me the name of this token.
The secret master's word whispered to the candidate on the 5 points of fellowship through the fellowship is Mahabon, which he is told means marrow in the bone. The name of the second token of the Melchizedek priesthood given by God through the veil on the 5 points of fellowship is health in the navel, marrow in the bones. Strength in the loins and in the sinews. Power in the priesthood be upon me and upon my posterity through all generations of time and throughout all eternity. And having given the master and having repeated it to God, the patron in the endowment is presented again immediately at the veil. Three taps are given and God says, "What is wanted?" And the person accompanying says, "Adam, having been true and faithful, Adam, having conversed with the Lord through the veil, desires to enter into his presence." And God says, "Let him enter." And that only costs you 10% of your income. Okay. All right. Now you draw your own conclusions about how much masonry is related to or derive, or how much the Mormon endowment is derived from masonry. And that was exactly 35 minutes. There are some questions, yeah. Yeah, the Oath of Vengeance was part of the endowment until about 1912, and it had been put into the endowment ceremony by Brigham Young, and it said essentially, and patrons were required to take this Oath of Vengeance, and it said essentially, we promise or we covenant that we shall never rest until we have avenged the blood of the prophets against the United States of America, and we shall teach our children this for the third to the third and fourth generation, or maybe it was the fourth and fifth generation. And the what? What?
That's kind of a Christian thing.
Well, I don't know. Until the third and fourth generation, that's a biblical phrase, of course. The problem arose when Reed Smoot, who was an apostle, was elected by the Utah legislature to serve as Utah's senator. And some folks that knew something about the Mormons raised a question. Some of the senators didn't want Smoot to be admitted to the Senate because he couldn't take an oath of allegiance to the United States because he'd gone through the Mormon endowment and taken an oath of allegiance to avenge the blood of the prophets against the United States. And the Senate took, about a year that they had lengthy Senate hearings as to whether to seat Reed Smoot. They subpoenaed the President Joseph F. Smith of the church, who had to go to Washington, and they questioned him, and he lied, of course. They asked him if he'd ever received a revelation. Well, no, I don't receive revelations. But he did admit that he had violated the law in continuing to cohabit with one of his wives after 1990. But the oath of vengeance was a problem, and as a result, the church removed that from the endowment. Other question?
It's more of a comment.
Yes.
I just want to say that all the information that you have given is readily available to anybody that investigates. And one of the means of control that the Masons and the Mormons have over their people is this secrecy. And you go to the temple and you can't talk about it. And you don't even know what's going to be there when you go in, before you go in. And then they get you to take this oath that you have no idea that you were going to have to take, and then it's all secret, and you can't talk about it. But anybody that really wants to know, it's all out there. You go to
absolutely right.
You know, Google Books nowadays, Sandra Tennis bookstore, any weird bookstore that has books on masonry and the Mormon.
Well, absolutely. William.
It's just a means of control, and it's
right. Right. Well, William Morgan's book. Of course, it got him killed, but his book was published and is available, and it's online, and you can read it. Yeah, yeah.
About what year did Brigham start that oath of allegiance? About what year?
I'm not sure. I don't know. Yeah, question.
So what books do you suggest?
Well, you can read William Morgan's book on illustrations of masonry, and... on the endowment, get the Tanner's book called "The Evolution of the Mormon of the LDS Endowment." It costs about $4, $5, something like that. The Tanner's, yeah, UTLM.org, Utah Lighthouse Ministry.org, yeah.
I'm just wondering why the Masons went through all this elaborate thing. What was the point of their mission?
Yeah.
I can see why Smith would rip off some of the ideas, but why were the Masons doing
it? How did it start with them? That's a good question.
Well, of course, I can't answer for the Masons. We're really out of time if some of you want to get lunch. But, I'll give a quick answer. I was asked for my opinion. I think that that Freemasonry, in its modern form, starting around the 17th century, 17th, 18th century, was essentially a quasi-political fraternal organization in which men got together, no women, right? Men got together to help each other and to support each other and to try to make each other better people. I don't go along with the conspiracy theories that the Masons run the country and are trying to take over the world, but that's, I'm not generally... Yeah, Gene.
Don't you think that perhaps those Masons in the 1700s were actually... part of the Enlightenment thinking?
Yes, that's a good point.
Worship,
yeah,
God.
Right. They tended, Masons in the 18th century tended to be the brightest people, and the best educated, and also very politically powerful. The American Revolution was basically run by Masons. I mean, George Washington and they were all... you look at your dollar bill, for crying out loud, you've got Masonic symbols on the dollar bill. So, yes, ma'am.
How do the apologists for the Mormon Church, how do they square that? Because that's a big deal, the nation thing in the temple. I mean, it's all out there. A lot of us know it. How do they square that?
Well, I think they stick to the explanation that an ancient ritual, you know, and it was part of Solomon's temple. Noah knew these rituals, and the Masons just corrupted it. They changed it, and they took out all of the sacred parts and the beautiful parts, and it was up to Joseph Smith to restore it. And Joseph Smith did. He restored it, and he also said that these are so sacred, these ordinances will never be changed. They cannot be changed. And, of course, all they've done ever since he started it was to change them.
So that's my question. What about the second endowment? Do they keep the purest things still there?
I don't think that the second endowment has anything to do with the Masons. That's a completely different kind of ritual that I think was just made up. God, we got a lot of questions. You know, yes, sir.
I don't know about you or maybe others here, but haven't any of you been indoctrinated into honorary societies like Phi Beta Kappa or Pi Kappa Phi?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
They have these grips, and they have certain oaths that you take and promises. And when this happened to me and I went through some of those, I thought at the time, you know, this also comes from the same period as the Masons. There's got to be something here that's very similar. And that's one of the things that got me thinking a little bit about
right,
it. Maybe
right.
There is something between Masonry, honorary societies, and this Mormon endowment. But even now, today, they still go through those rituals, except here in Utah. If you're inducted into, say, Phi Beta Kappa at the University of Utah, like I was, they don't go through the right ceremony and giving you the grace.
They've corrupted that too, huh? Yeah.
So the one thing that struck me, when you were talking about the Book of Mormon, you talked about the anti-Masonry movement, mm-hmm. which was afoot in New York, which coincides with when Joseph was probably formulating this thing. Has anyone done any research to show the ideological shift of Joseph possibly being anti-Mason in the early 1830s to pro-Mason in the 1840s? Has anybody done...
Not that I'm aware of. Actually, I should have mentioned some. I had it in my notes, and then I happened to skip that line. It's a very strange coincidence, I think, that William Morgan's widow, remember who William Morgan was? Yeah. William Morgan's widow later married Joseph Smith as a plural wife. So... Okay, I think if you have more questions, come up and I'll answer them because most folks don't want to stay. They want to have lunch.